Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Hoffman, and as usual, it's become sort of a weekly ritual. We're going to invite an expert to join me in fielding your question. She is none other than Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. Layla is a registered dietitian. She also holds a master's degree in the field of nutrition. And we got a bunch of questions to answer, but first of all, welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast once again, Layla. It's nice having you aboard.
Oh, thanks so much, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you.
Good. So before we get to questions, you're busily at work on a new presentation, which
yes.
You're going to offer in New York City this month, in fact, in just a very few weeks, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes. In a couple of weeks, How to Alzheimer's Proof Your Brain, which will be Wednesday, October 23rd at 6 p.m. Reservations are a must. I'm going to talk all about Alzheimer's disease, the relationship to metabolism and diet, and how much we actually do have in our control to prevent it, even reverse it to some degree, all of that. So very, very exciting information about how to Alzheimer's proof your brain.
And you're going to talk about some of the supplements that are useful
yes.
for that as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Good. All right. So, these presentations are always very, very educational, very worthwhile, and we will be handing out honorary PhDs afterwards. There will be a spot quiz at the end, but if you pass, you will get your PhD. I mean, I think it's an amazing education that we are offering via these seminars. The people who are regulars are really accumulating a knowledge base because you kind of go through a wide variety of subjects that relate to nutrition. What are some of the subjects we've tackled in the past?
Let's see, vitamin D and chronic disease.
Insulin resistance,
metabolic syndrome, diabetes, food and mood is another one that's actually quite
popular. Gastrointestinal problems.
Yes, GI.
Right. Osteoporosis, I think you mentioned that.
Osteoporosis, yeah. Yes. Enhancing our resistance to illness, during cold and flu season.
The dangers
GMOs.
Of GMOs we talked
yeah.
about, yeah. Also,
yeah.
We had one on that. Actually, we've done two because we did a reprise of our presentation on natural cosmetics and natural
yes.
Shampoos, soaps, and so on because of the mm-hmm. dangers inherent in some of the chemicals that are present in these commercial products.
Yes,
and so
we have to be careful of our toxic environment and the obesogens that may be associated with all of that. And yeah.
And of course, weight loss has been a frequent topic as well because that's the perennial topic. How do I lose weight? So
right.
We've covered that in detail, how to deal with food cravings and so on. So this actually is a relaunch of our series. We had a little bit of a summer hiatus, but the weather is cool and brisk here in New York. We're getting back down to work in earnest, and we're relaunching the maybe we should call them the Intelligent Medicine Lecture Series.
Yes.
Right? Why not?
Yeah. That sounds fabulous. Yes.
Right. Okay. So let's.
And then we can hand out Intelligent Medicine certificates.
Diplomas.
At the
yeah.
end of at the end of each year or each season of. Oh, that sounds great.
Go for it.
Okay.
Okay. So so that's the 23rd, and mm-hmm. I'd be sure to schedule my podcast early on that date, so that I can be available and be down there and help field questions because a lively Q&A session usually ensues after your great presentations. All right, so let's see what we have in the email bag. We've got a lot of questions, and they come to us in various ways. They come to us via our patients. They come to us via Facebook and the Internet. And the email address for questions is radioprogram@AOL.com. Now, make your questions as simple as possible and try to make them of general interest because if you have a very detailed and complex medical problem, we're not going to handle it for you. But questions of general interest, you'll get the idea as we share questions and field them here on this Q&A podcast. All right, so I'm going to start with this one because I was talking to a patient the other day about the paleo diet, and the idea, of course, behind the paleo diet is that we eat foods that are not modern or more recently domesticated foods. Now, this is a hard call to make because some foods were domesticated 10 or 15,000 years ago. Others only arrived in a modern form very recently. So it's a question of how far back do you have to go to arrive at a true paleo diet? And does it matter? Does it really matter? I actually just interviewed a great guy. He is Dr. Daniel Lieberman, and he wrote a book called The Truth of the Human Body. I'm sorry, The Story of the Human Body. The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. We did a podcast with him. You can find it at our podcast page, drhoffman.com/podcasts.
It's also in your latest newsletter.
And it's also the subject of, yeah. I did a book review on that, and I think it's a great book. And in talking to Dr. Lieberman, you know, he believes that we should learn lessons from our Paleolithic ancestors, but to is it always necessary to fully emulate precisely what they ate and what they did? It may or may not make a difference based on your own biological individuality. So, but the question revolves around, are cashews a legume? Now, I'm going to admit, quite frankly, I always thought that cashews are very closely related to peanuts. I just thought that they were, you know, they look like peanuts.
Yeah.
They've got two, you know, parts to them. And I always thought that they were very, so my answer was, yeah, I think they're a legume. So what say you, Layla?
Well, I've read that cashews are a fruit, but peanuts are definitely a legume.
Right. That
so,
so
yeah.
As opposed to other nuts, you know, call it a peanut, but actually it's a legume. It grows in the ground like legumes do, like beans do.
Mm-hmm.
It is, it's a bean, basically. And roasted and toasted, it has a nutty flavor. But so, say for example, here's an important example. A lot of people allergic to peanuts. Will that necessarily make them allergic to cashews?
Not necessarily.
Right.
There are some people who are terribly allergic to peanuts, but not to the other tree nuts,
right,
as we classify the rest of the nuts that are out there. So
I was kind of surprised by the answer to this question, because like I say, I cast my lot that cashews were close to peanuts and that they probably were legumes. As you say, you know, kudos to you, cashews are not a legume. Cashews are the seed of the cashew tree. And in a sense, they're a fruit because they grow on the outside of the fruit. So in a fruit, they are a part of the fruit structure, and they grow on a tree, unlike peanuts. You know, I mean, look, us Northerners, we don't know from how peanuts grow. You know, we Yankees. But if you're from Georgia or you're from the South, like Jimmy Carter, your peanut farmer, you know that there is no such thing as a peanut tree. Peanuts grow in the ground.
Right.
And however, there is such a thing as a cashew tree. And the cashews grow as part of the fruit of the cashew tree. And so what's interesting is that there's actually toxins present. You never see cashews sold whole in their shells, because toxins present require cashews to be harvested by people literally wearing protective suits for protection. And they have to be roasted to remove the oils. So cashews, they're similar in some ways to almonds, walnuts, and pistachios, which are drupes. That's D-R-U-P-E-S. So they're not true nuts, but they're also not a legume. So they're kind of like, you know, neither fish nor fowl.
They're
and,
a droop.
Yeah, they're droops. And what would you say about the nutritional qualities of cashews, you know, when it comes to the oils present?
They're probably similar to the other nuts, or, pardon me, droops,
right,
as well. What I find very interesting is I will have patients come in at, what kind of nuts do you eat? I eat cashews. All I eat are cashews. And it's very interesting to me, not just that it's classified as a fruit, but it also has a sweet flavor.
Yeah.
Much more so than any of the other droops.
It's kind of a good dessert nut, you know, for if you're trying to beat your sweet cravings, and instead of reaching for a cookie or sweet chocolate, you can have, and I do this frequently, I'll have nuts, I'll usually have almonds, but sometimes I'll have some cashews, and they make a great sort of end piece to the meal.
My favorite actually is pistachios, and I also like that you have
too.
To fight for it.
Yeah, well, that's right. The nice thing about pistachios is that unless you get the shelled kind, you have to kind of work, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it slows you down,
yeah,
which is a good thing when it comes to eating nuts, because they are fairly calorie dense. They're rich in fats. They have some carbohydrates. What would you say to the omega-3 content of cashews?
Not as good as walnuts.
Thank you.
Walnuts are primarily the highest in omega-3. That's why that's the most heart-healthy nut.
Right.
The walnut.
Thank you. That is correct. And actually, one of the ways you can know this is that tropical nuts, more from equatorial areas, and cashews mostly are grown in Brazil, from what I know, but probably other parts of the world. But anyway, they're equatorial, more tropical nuts. Nuts that are grown in more temperate climates, like walnuts and hazelnuts. That's a kind of a good Thanksgiving type nut, and I think it was available to the settlers in a more temperate climate in North America and the Native Americans. The more north or south you are of the equator in a more temperate climate, the more omega-3 will be present, because omega-3 acts as kind of an antifreeze for plants and animals. So I got to say, I've adopted a really healthy habit. Is every time I make a salad, I have some bags of crushed walnuts.
Wonderful.
That I get at Trader Joe's.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the turnover at Trader Joe's is quick enough that the nuts aren't stale.
Yes.
And, gee, maybe we should get them as a sponsor, because this does sound a little like a commercial for Trader Joe's.
I actually want to talk a little bit about nuts in the shell, like walnuts and almonds. They just taste so wonderfully fresh.
Yeah.
Not very easy to do when you're making a salad and you just want to throw a handful of walnuts in there or something, but you know,
right.
It's just nice to kind of have around.
Right. And, of course, you need some tools. You need one of those nutcrackers and a picker.
And does anybody remember what those look like? Because nobody's buying nuts in the shell anymore. Although they do exist, they're in the grocery store. They're in the produce aisle. Go get some, everybody. It's good. Especially the walnuts are very tasty.
I'm lazy, but you know, the last time I cracked open walnuts, I can't even remember when. And you know, if I had to do it, I'd have to go get the pliers. I don't even have that little tool that we used to have when I was growing up. So anyway, but the good part of it is they're fresher, and also. They are, it slows you down. You have to do the work. So that's very Paleolithic, is doing the work to get the food. Not, you know, getting that, 16-ounce carton of orange juice and guzzling it down, but, arduously finding the oranges, climbing up the tree, picking them. and then eating the whole orange.
It's very easy, too, to open up, say, a canister or a bag full of nuts, and then before you know it, you know, if you're busy watching TV or something online, you know, the bag is gone and you've just consumed a pound of nuts. That's a whole lot of calories. Fighting for it is good. Fighting for it is good.
And by the way, while we're riffing on nuts, studies show that vegetarians who don't consume nuts, you would think, well, that's even better than a nut consumer, because nuts are full of fat. The vegetarians who add nuts to their diet, they did this in studying Seventh-day Adventists, actually have a lower rate of cardiovascular disease than if you don't have nuts. So nuts have cardiovascular protective properties. It may be the oils in the nuts, it may be the fibers, it may be other compounds that are found in nuts. However, there was a big brouhaha lately when the Diamond Almond Company was sent a regulatory letter by the Food and Drug Administration. It sounded really like a Gestapo letter, where they said
lately,
you have to cease and desist with your health claims about these almonds, even though that they were true, because your almonds now constitute a drug. And we can't suggest that almonds are healthy for you, because otherwise they become a medication, and then you have to apply through the Food and Drug Administration, and yada, yada, yada.
Well, get ready, everybody, because food is medicine.
Yes.
It's got vitamins, minerals, other micronutrients, phytochemicals. And with the nuts, besides having healthy fat like almonds, also lots of magnesium, also good for the heart. So, you know.
There you go.
It's
all
there.
Right. All
Nature's
right.
original functional food.
Okay.
Nuts, droops.
So there's our riff on cashews. question about B12. Now, this is an interesting question, because this question really goes to the heart of the fidelity and tenacity of my listeners. I mean, they don't miss a beat, and they want to track down this information. They're very, very zealous. So listen to this. This is an email from Marianne. I just got it. Hello, Dr. Altman. I love the show, and appreciate the information greatly. Thank you so much. I've been trying to find the interview you did perhaps 1 to 2 years ago on Health Talk with the expert on vitamin B12. He was adamant that the recommended levels are too low and that this deficiency is an insidious and often unrecognized culprit in many illnesses. Is it possible that you remember his name, website, or book, if he had one? Thanks so much, Marianne. So the answer is no. And I don't remember. And perhaps I need to take more B12. My memory fails me. But I see such a large volume of guests. And part of the problem is that this was a long time ago. And this may have been long before we began to archive our information about guests, which is something that we're studiously going to do going forward. And especially with our new website, it'll provide us with ways that listeners can search for subjects and for the names of guests or the names of books, and it'll make it a lot easier. That website is said to debut this month, but you know how it is. It's like remodeling a kitchen. It's going to be done in, they say it's going to be done in October.
Well, add 40% more time to that.
Right. Yeah. I'd be happy if it were done by, Thanksgivica.
That's right. It's not going to happen for 7,000 years, Dr. Hoffman.
Right. Is something like 78,000
years.
You know, yeah. This better enjoy it while it lasts, because this is the only one we're going to experience 100%. So the point being, let's address the question, because I don't think we need necessarily to find a specific website or track down an expert or a book, because this is not such an esoteric opinion. That the recommended levels of B12 are too low, that this deficiency is an insidious and often unrecognized culprit in many illnesses. What say you, Layla, about that?
I don't like the standard range that are given, that's given on lab tests, like between 200 and 900. We see people in the 200, even in the 300 range. They've got issues, definitely, whether it's fatigue or neurological issues. I like to see levels at least in the 600s. What about you?
Yeah, and here's how I do it. I mean, if a patient is suffering from any kind of fatigue, mm-hmm. or memory problem or mental performance problem or depression, I will be even more aggressive about supplementing B12, even if it's in the normal range. So if I say somebody's really tired and their B12 is 400, but that's in the normal range, I might be more inclined to give them B12. Here's the problem, is the current tests we're using for B12 do not tell us about the functional status of B12. And so it's good to do a B12 test. The traditional B12 test is sometimes we'll pick up a B12 deficiency, but often we'll see people in that borderline zone. They may be 300-400, you know, that's considered normal. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple of other tests, and as you know, we do these tests, Layla. One is called an MMA, the methylmalonic acid test.
Yeah.
And in that test is more sensitive for functional B12 deficiency. Also, homocysteine will pick up B12 deficiency, but the problem is if you have an elevated homocysteine, it might be due to B12 or it might be due to folic acid or B6 or a combination of those, or other factors in the body. Or certainly there's a genetic component there at work too, but B vitamins help to lower homocysteine. So, I would look at B12 as more of a functional vitamin, where, in a similar way that we look at vitamin D, you know, that's a very good analogy, because we have a range for vitamin D. They say if you're 20 to 80, now they've raised that to 100, you're in the ballpark. Fine, no problem. So if you're 23, they'll say, hey, you're not deficient. But we know that you need a lot more vitamin D to feel optimal, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And we would call that deficient, you and I,
yeah.
A level of 23.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it deficiency, maybe in the formal sense, it's not going to cause rickets, but there are a lot of problems that will happen in the lower range of certain of these vitamins, and that, you know, while you may not have some of the classic problems of B12 deficiency, what happens when you're B12 deficient? You have peripheral neuropathy. What else?
Like you said, memory problems, fatigue. The fatigue usually can be quite extreme. People
right.
are requiring naps where they never did before, you know.
And problem.
Even though, think about it, B12 does recycle in the body. It takes a long time for somebody to be overtly deficient in B12, less than 200. We normally see those in vegetarians, or especially vegans,
right.
who are not getting any animal protein or not taking a
supplement. Or sometimes people taking acid-blocking medication, or with where
yes.
their digestive system has checked out, they have a condition called pernicious anemia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's how I would answer the question, Marianne. And, you know, I think that's a good idea for a show topic. We ought to focus in again on the importance of vitamin B12. Maybe we'll find that guy, whoever that guy is.
Yeah.
Meantime, I think I'll take some sublingual B12 and maybe it'll just pop right back into my head.
Oh, and just to add another note about the methylmalonic acid.
Yes, yes.
That's normally, that number, when it's high, it means there's a deficiency. People should understand.
Yes, it's a reflex. In other words,
low
is
inverse.
Normal.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Low is normal, high is, yeah.
I would also say this, is that there are certain patients who have normal B12s. We still give them B12 shots. Mm-hmm. Now, conventional doctors would say, well, that's a waste of time. You have a normal B12, why give a B12 shot? B12 shots energize people. They also help certain conditions like peripheral neuropathy. They just help, even though levels of B12 are adequate. Sometimes by supercharging B12, we get good results. So, B12 is one of those things where I think poorly understood. When I read articles about B12 in the nutrition journals, there are a lot of unanswered questions about what is the optimal form of B12. Do patients with low B12 need injections? Can they just take oral B12? And what should be the cutoff for administering B12? Well, of course, they're going to be very conservative. We tend to be more proactive.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. This comes to us, this next question. Do you have any questions?
Actually, yeah, I do have a question. This one is from Karen. And Karen says, "Hi, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you so much for your podcast. They're informative. I'm gaining knowledge. You have a way of explaining things that keeps it simple and entertaining, too, which is great. Thank you, Karen.
Great.
Her question, she talks about her blood work. She's concerned about low triglycerides. Her triglycerides are 26. Let me give you some of the other numbers here.
Sure.
Her HDL is 117.
Wow, that's, like, great.
Yeah.
Incredibly.
Her LDL is 112, and her triglycerides are 26.
Well, that's
very
unusual. You know, HDL higher than LDL. Wow.
Yeah. Now, her triglycerides are low. She's concerned about her triglycerides being so low. And, of course, she looked online, and she's wondering if her thyroid is involved or something like that. But, Dr. Hoffman, when do we see an HDL this high? Normally.
Well, rarely.
Rarely. Yeah. But we do see HDLs over 90 in many patients with low thyroid.
Right. And that actually, I think, you know, you worked at the Atkins Center, and this is actually one of the theories developed by the late, great Dr. Robert Atkins. And I think to some extent it holds true, although there are some people who just are walking around with very, very protective levels of HDL. This is generally a very good thing and not indicative of a problem, but highly protective. So, you know, maybe that's worth checking out. I also have this to say about very low triglycerides. I've noticed that in patients with multiple sclerosis, look, I don't want to scare Karen because this doesn't necessarily mean she's got a problem, but I've noticed that in some patients with multiple sclerosis, they have very low levels of triglycerides. It's almost as if they don't have the ability to hold on to fat, and fat is a component of the myelin sheath that surrounds the neurons in the brain and in the central nervous system. And MS is a demyelinating disease. So, you know, one wonders, is there some sort of metabolic derangement by which fat is very, very low, or there's a tendency to malabsorb fat?
The other thing about low triglycerides would be malnutrition, but she does give us her height and weight, which is completely normal.
Mm-hmm.
She's an active person, so I don't think there's anything there. She's 5'7 and 140, which is right spot on as far as I'm concerned.
Right. Well, this helps
the other thing with low triglycerides, however, is if she's in a fat-burning metabolism, triglycerides can be quite low. I've seen levels as low as 40.
In other words, a very low carbohydrate.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. So that's a possibility. But I think it's worth investigating further, especially with that HDL. What do you think?
To some extent, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
If she feels fine, then probably nothing to worry about. But it might be worth getting some additional tests to see if there's an accompanying issue, such as hypothyroidism. I mean, the other point to make is this is almost an embarrassment of riches. We tend to look very askance at high levels of triglycerides, even more so than conventional doctors. Conventional doctors will say, you know, get it under 120, get it under 100. We like to see triglycerides, under 70 or 60, because, you know, as you have frequently pointed out in your lectures, it's an indication of what?
It's an indication of good metabolism and for longevity. Three criteria for people who live the longest: they have the lowest triglycerides, they have the highest HDL, and they have the lowest fasting insulin.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something.
In other words, when we see a patient who has a fasting triglyceride of 120 or 150, that might not catch the eye so much of a conventional doctor, but
right.
We tend to think of it as a sign of insulin resistance.
Insulin resistance, a risk factor certainly for heart disease. Those triglycerides floating around the bloodstream, the higher they are, the more our bloodstream resembles a milkshake.
Right. Well, and I've seen it. We've actually, when we draw blood from a patient with very high triglycerides, you know, blood is red. And it's like dark red. Everybody's seen blood because, you know, you've seen, violent movies if you haven't cut yourself. Patients, when you draw a tube of blood from a patient with high triglycerides, it looks like borscht with sour cream. Do you have any relatives
exactly
who eat
right.
borscht? I mean,
yes.
I have relatives from Russia, Poland, and they used to eat borscht. So you'd start with like a beet red, liquid, and then you'd dissolve some sour cream in it, and it would make this really cool pink color,
yes.
you know, but sort of creamy pink. And that's because the fat gets dissolved into the blood, and it actually makes it look creamy pink.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird.
That's my mother's borscht. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. I grew up on that. That's exactly right.
Okay. That's not too bad.
Yeah.
All right. So this one comes to us. This is from a patient, a very astute patient of ours, who often sends us questions accompanied by detailed articles that she wants us to comment on, which is okay because, it's informative. And that's what we do. You know, we're a consultative practice, and patients want the best possible nutritional advice. And there are a lot of controversies, and sometimes you hear something in the office, and then something new comes up. And this is a patient who wants to get the 411 on something new that she came across. It's, "Dear Layla, you got this one. I'm attaching an article I received from my health food store arguing that breast cancer survivors should avoid full fat dairy.
Oh yeah.
During our recent visit, though, you advised that I use full fat, not low fats. We did, however, discuss dairy specifically." So, she's catching you in a little bit of a paradox here. On the one hand, we're not a fan of low-fat dairy, but now just to briefly read this article here. This article is courtesy of a health food store, and they printed it up to hand to their patrons. And it's April 20th, 2013. The study was published Thursday, so it was done in the spring, in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. The people who are diagnosed with breast cancer and then go on to consume a steady diet of high-fat dairy foods increase their chances of dying years earlier than those who consumed low to non-fat milk products. This patient, since we're keeping her name anonymous, we know that she's a breast cancer survivor many years ago. She's doing great, but she's concerned, could this tip the odds in favor of her having a recurrence of breast cancer? The researchers looked at dietary habits of nearly 1,900 women, mostly California patients diagnosed with early stage breast cancer from 1997 and 2000. So
what I noticed about that study,
yes, go ahead.
I'm reading, what they singled out, and I emailed her back my point of view, it's very interesting that the dairy that they singled out were milk,
yeah.
condensed or evaporated milk,
mm-hmm.
ice cream, and custards.
Oh, okay.
All of which contain sugar.
Yeah.
And we know that sugar
feeds
cancer.
And the milk has the natural sugar, but then there's added sugar in some
yes.
of these other things. Okay.
Yes. The other thing about dairy and cancer is the insulin-like growth factor.
Yes.
That we have to take into
consideration. Or the bovine growth hormone that may be mm-hmm. added to conventional dairy, which is it's a growth factor for cow mammary glands.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how good is that for people to consume, especially female people who've had a bout of breast cancer? And I really think that for men with prostate cancer, for women with breast cancer or high risk of breast cancer, maybe dairy is something to put away. you know, and just not go there.
I agree. I agree.
However, and I've wrestled with this myself. I personally have tested allergic to wheat and dairy. Those are my primary allergies, to some extent yeast. And I follow a yeast-free, wheat-free, dairy-free diet. But recently I added back dairy because I seemed to be tolerant of it, and it tasted good. And, you know, putting a little, you know, cheese in your omelet, or, you know, sprinkling some feta cheese into a salad seemed like a good idea. But I recently abandoned that. And the reason is I found that, in my case, it may actually exacerbate bodily aches and pains. I have a family history of arthritis. My mom had very severe rheumatoid arthritis. I'm fine. But I'm an exerciser, and I'm also in my seventh decade. That's a little hard to say, but it's true. And I feel better off of the dairy. I mean, there's some deprivation involved because, there's many opportunities to have dairy. It's hard to eat in a restaurant without getting dairy. But I think it's a way to go.
We as human beings don't need dairy. Once we're weaned from the breast, we're continuing to take milk from other animals, cow, sheep, goat, all of that. We really don't need dairy at all. They're full of growth factors meant for growing infants, not for us. And dairy is an insulin trigger too, which does not help, especially in the setting of cancer.
Right.
So, you know, that's the other thing. None of us really need dairy at all, you know. So, no, you're absolutely better off without cheese.
Right.
Yeah, and you miss it, but really, how much can you miss it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And, I guess the consolation for some people is, staying off wheat and dairy is a pretty good way to avoid excess weight gain, because that level of care and restriction sometimes helps to lower your calorie consumption overall.
And nutritional gold standard in preventing or trying to reverse the progression of any autoimmune diseases is the removal of gluten and dairy.
But, I have to say, though, there's a very persistent effort to convince Americans to eat low-fat dairy. You see that?
Oh, golly.
You see that in the DASH diet. Ugh. The DASH diet is the
well, you know, the National Dairy Council and the USDA and the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, they're all in on it together, and so forth and so on.
Right.
Forget the low-fat dairy. Low-fat will only have more lactose in it, which
right.
is unfortunate, which is another sugar to avoid, actually. But, you know, we are the highest dairy-eating nation, and we have the highest rates of osteoporosis.
Right. So it's certainly not forestalling that.
Yeah.
So, okay, now I'm going to just jump into this controversy because I met a guy the other day. I don't remember where, but we were talking about food choices. And I told him exactly what I shared with the audience, that I feel a little more achy when I take in dairy. And he said, but what about unpasteurized raw milk?
Oh, right, yeah.
And I said, well, I can't get unpasteurized raw milk. He said, well, I can, because he lives somewhere up in Vermont near a farm, and he gets this raw dairy. He said, I bet if you had unpasteurized raw dairy, you would be okay. And that's the, what's the organization that promotes that?
Weston A. Price.
The Weston A. Price folks promote the intake of raw dairy, which is, you know, not quite Paleolithic, but it's dairy as God intended.
God intended, exactly. I mean, that's got to be better than the pasteurized, I have to agree. But again, it's great if you're a calf.
Exactly.
I mean, any of it, raw or not, it's that's really what it comes down to.
Right. So having been weaned at the tender age of, I don't even think my mother breastfed me. I think I just had formula.
I don't think it was popular back then.
It wasn't. It was like my mother was a modern mom in 1952. It was a thing, if you're a little more upscale, and, that was more for the impoverished women who couldn't afford the modern conveniences of formula milk. Mm-hmm. And now we know so much better.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So this guy's... This guy got upset, Michael from Connecticut. He said, after listening to your podcast interview with Lauren Cordain, and I can't read all this, but
that's a long one.
Yeah, it's a long one. He says Dr. Cordain mentioned at the beginning of the interview that there was no physiologic difference between refined salt and unrefined salt. And Michael doesn't like this assertion. And I'm going to go back to this interview I did with Lauren Cordain. It's an excellent interview, and you can find it at drhoffman.com/podcast. So if you're listening to this podcast, you probably know that. It's redundant of me to say that, but it's one of the podcasts that's on the podcast page. So, you know, scroll down, and it's very important for you to listen to this. Dr. Cordain has written that there are certain factors that differentiate our modern diet from the Paleolithic diet. And the most obvious factor is we consume much more sugar. And another factor is we consume much more in the way of refined carbohydrates and less fiber. And another thing is that the sodium-potassium ratio in our diets has changed. And so what he's saying is not so much that we should eliminate salt, but that...
And we shouldn't.
And this is another thing. Is a lot of, you know, conventional dietary recommendations are low salt, low salt, low salt. And for some people, that is important. You know, if you have congestive heart failure, very bad kidneys, or certain types of hypertension, mm-hmm. I think African Americans are more prone to that sodium responsive hypertension, but not all hypertensives. Then sodium restriction makes sense. But the amount of sodium that we consume in the American diet is astronomical. It's mostly coming from processed foods. It's not coming from the salt shaker. And we consume very little potassium, so it's a matter of balance. And so why don't you talk a little bit about the difference between refined and unrefined salt? What are some of the differences?
First of all, refined salt is also going to have some anti-caking agents and things like that, like silica aluminates and thiosulfates and among other things. I like the idea of unrefined salt. I like the rock salt, the Himalayan salt, or the
Celtic
pink salt.
Yeah.
Beautiful. All of that. Salts. Celtic salt, all mm-hmm. of that.
They look like dirt salt. They're either with a sort of a pink or orange hue.
Yeah.
Or the kind that I have in my salt shaker that I grind, it looks kind of dirty. It's like, oh, it's not like white bread. It's like whole wheat bread version of
right,
salt.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I think the salt actually tastes better. These are the types of salts I use at home. And by the way, we're not getting the majority of our sodium from the salt shaker at all. It's as you said, it's from all the processed foods we eat and the very little produce we eat. We're not getting the potassium that we need from our produce, particularly our vegetables.
Right.
And
to balance out the salt. So, okay. So just parenthetically, I'm a terrible patient. I rarely go to the doctor, unless I do something really extreme like break a hip. And I don't get my blood pressure checked. And I eat a ton of salt. I mean, I eat pickles and I put salt on most of my foods. But the unrefined salt, sea salt or Himalayan salt or Celtic salt. And so perchance the other day, I was getting an IV. I was getting a Myers cocktail because my muscles were sore and I thought I could use an infusion of magnesium. By the way, it worked great for my sore muscles. I did it 2 days in a row and it just really was really helpful.
That Myers cocktail is wonderful.
Yeah, for sore muscles. A lot of our athletes utilize that. So I said to our nurse, McKenna, I said, please check my blood pressure. And usually it's like, I get a pass because I'm the doctor. But I said, no, you like treat me like a patient, check my blood pressure. And relatively to my surprise, she looked up with wide eyes and she said, it's 100 over 70.
That's
which
terrific.
Which is kind of low. So, I mean, I guess I don't have to worry about hypertension, and I don't feel weak
and
woozy.
And you don't have to worry about salt.
I certainly don't have to worry about salt, and you know what I notice is that it's sort of like a paradoxical rule, is the very same people who really have least to worry about salt are also the most conscientious about its avoidance. So we'll get these really skinny, very active women who do yoga and exercise and aerobics, and they're on very low sodium diets because they know that it's virtuous not to consume salt or sodium. And then when we check their blood pressure, it's even low. It's like 90 over 60. So but the people who are, big fat slobs who, blood pressure through the roof, they eat like, meatball heroes and pepperoni pizzas. They're the ones who really need to restrict their excess sodium.
Yeah, and high blood pressure is mostly a function of weight gain or being overweight. Only 10% of the population have salt, sodium high blood pressure that is sodium sensitive at all. So it's really not, you know, sodium is also important in the body. It's one of the electrolytes. Does that mean go home and use your salt shaker everywhere? No, it doesn't.
Different strokes for different folks. I think we have to individualize those recommendations because these blanket recommendations, like what Bloomberg was trying to do to restrict salt in restaurants. Fast food notwithstanding, I don't think that all restaurants in New York should be subjected to a sodium code that needs to be enforced by the health department to improve the health of New Yorkers. I think that personal choice and education enter into that.
Yeah, I'm against blanket recommendations. I really am. It has to be individual. We all have a unique biochemistry. I'm not a fan of blanket recommendations at all. And especially just, you know, having low-fat milk in the schools and nothing else. That's another thing that's ridiculous.
By the way, they just did a study on that, on the effects of introducing low-fat milk into schools. And what they found is that it had absolutely zero impact on the rate of obesity. So that is a, that's a misguided effort.
Well, they have to stop feeding them pizza and French fries, just the addition of low-fat milk.
Right. Right.
Is he going to do it either? Yeah.
All right. Anyway. So do you have any more?
Actually, I have one. I have one for you.
Okay.
Dr. Hoffman, this is from Christine.
Okay.
Christine says, I don't know if you've addressed the subject yet this season, but I wanted your opinion on the flu shot.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if it would be prudent for an 80-year-old female who was hospitalized last year for pneumonia.
Right.
I realize you can't give specific advice, mm-hmm. but I want to weigh the potential benefits versus the risk, if any, before helping my mom make a decision.
Okay, so that's an excellent question, and this is, flu season is upon us. It usually comes in the fall. The reason being that, well, number one, people stay inside and they close the windows. So germs that are transmitted via coughs and sneezes are transmitted more readily in a cold environment. But also it turns out that the flu virus prefers a cooler temperature, not an ice-cold temperature, but cool temperatures, 40, 50 degrees is a more optimal temperature for the proliferation of the flu virus. So these epidemics traditionally hit us in the winter months and fall months. And so my answer to that question is I'm an agnostic about the flu shot, and I'll tell you why. I don't think it has horrible downsides, as some people may allege. I mean, rarely there are cases of people who have severe reactions to the flu shot, but usually the reaction is mild and transient. Sometimes people actually feel flu-like from the flu shot, which isn't great. I wish I had a buck for every patient I saw last year who got the flu shot and within a week or two came down with what seemed like a case of the flu. Now, either the flu shot was not protective or the flu shot itself caused the flu-like symptoms. And to illustrate that, the very interesting situation, because they had Dr. Oz on the Dr. Oz show administered a flu shot to Piers Morgan of CNN, the host on CNN. It's kind of a publicity stunt, and it is a way of illustrating that the flu shot is okay, public service. We're going to show, roll up your sleeves, be brave, and take one for your civic duty, Piers Morgan, and show the world that it's a good thing to do. So he did it. 2 days later on his show, and there's actually a YouTube video on it, he is sick as a dog. He is sick as a dog, and actually he has a guest on the show. I forget his guest name, Piers Morgan can barely talk his way through the interview, and he goes into a paroxysm of coughing, and the guest says to him, one thing I'm not going to do is go on the Dr. Oz show and get a flu shot this year. He was kind of ribbing him about that. Okay. That being said, I think that those reactions are probably, few and far between. The problem with the flu shot is that the very people that it's supposed to protect, it is least effective for. So, for example, statistics show that for people like this person's mom, who was in the hospital with pneumonia, an older immunosuppressed individual, the flu shot is only its effectiveness is only in the teens, and like maybe 17%, because they don't have a good, healthy immune system. You need a good, healthy immune system to take the flu antigen that's in the shot and process it into an immune system response. If your immune system is not robust, you will not get a response. Now, younger people will get a response, so they can avoid maybe a few days of misery. And there is a somewhat protective effect in younger people. They still can get another type of flu that's coming around the bend that the flu shot doesn't cover. So it's not 100% protection. But I say this, is, you know, I hate like hell getting a flu. It's horrible. I just don't like any downtime. I'm a real crybaby. I'm a sissy complainer. But when I get it, I try to console myself with the idea that this is Paleolithic illness, is that we are designed not to be in perfect health and feel great all the time, but to experience ups and downs of health. And that's the way the immune system works. And the immune system has to process foreign invaders for it to stay on its toes. And, you know, it's a little bit another way of saying what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Yeah.
And I actually think that, I mean, so you cook, you know, you got a temperature of 101 or 102. That may be beneficial in some ways for the body. It's been shown that hyperthermia kills cancer cells. Mm-hmm. Past a certain age, we all have cancer cells in our body, whether they're tiny nests of cancer cells in our women and have them in their breasts, men have them in their prostates. Mm-hmm. So the answer is, I'm not sure that, all in all, the flu shot is doing a heck of a lot of good. Now, there are people who are dispatched by the flu. You know, they caught the flu and they died. But that's more in exceptional epidemics. In 1918, we had a very, very serious flu. Haven't had that type of epidemic in a long time.
Wasn't that more from the cytokine storm?
Yeah, but that was a little atypical, because that was a type of flu that killed a lot of young people. So that is a different kind of flu. The ordinary seasonal flu doesn't usually behave like that. Also, it was the pre-antibiotic era, and most people died of secondary infections, which these days could have been treated with antibiotics. You know, you start with a flu and then you develop a problem. Look, I mean, reasonable advice, people who have emphysema, diabetes, conditions where they're sort of teetering on the brink, and if they get sick, they can't afford to be sick because it would really cause them a real, you know, they would be circling the drain. These are people who might get the flu shot, but conversely, they're the very self same people who would respond least well to the flu shot.
Yeah.
So that's my take on it. And then, you know, why don't we talk about some natural things while we're at it to close the podcast?
For prevention of the flu? This is going to sound, and I know I got it from the CDC website, but it's true. Folks, wash your hands.
Okay.
When you arrive at the office, go wash your hands, especially if you've been strap hanging on the subway and touching things. When you come home from work, wash your hands before you handle anything.
Mm-hmm.
Bring your hands to your face. Cook with any food. 50% flu reduction if you simply wash your hands. Should you be OCD in washing your hands all day long? Of course not. But when you arrive somewhere, wash your hands.
I always do that now. That was the first thing I do when I get home.
Yes.
Is I will, you know, I just go in the bathroom and wash my hands, because I know I've been in touch, you know, manually with the exhalations and germs of a lot of people.
Absolutely. That's something that's other ingrained in us.
Why bring it into the house? And so the other thing I would say along those lines is don't pick your nose.
It is a route of entry.
But it's amazing the number of people who, you know, look, they don't do it in public because already they, you know, they're aware that this is a faux pas.
But I've seen it in public, but whatever.
But surreptitiously, they get that finger up into their nose because it is such a habit. And that is a great route for the other way is, you know, don't start rubbing your eyes. I mean, the temptation is to, you know, you feel tired and you knead your palms into your eyes. Well, that mucous membrane is a great way of transferring viruses into your respiratory tract because it go right in there. I would say that this is actually a more important route than if you know, somebody says, hey, taste this chicken. It's just outstanding. Just have a little taste. And they hand their fork over to you, and you go, are you okay? Are you well? That's probably less of a way to transmit a respiratory virus like the flu or a cold, because it's less likely to go via the gastrointestinal tract than it is via the respiratory tract.
Thank goodness for our stomach acids, which help us out with that. Yeah.
I mean, you know, you know, somebody is suffering from vomiting and serious diarrhea, they probably aren't going to be sitting at your dinner table. Those are the people who have bacteria that could be transmitted via the oral route.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and then nutrient-wise, I mean...
Oh, nutrient-wise, for food prevention, vitamin D. And vitamin D and vitamin D and get your levels checked first.
Or, and the strategy that you use is you will tan a little bit in the winter.
Yeah, tan a little bit in the winter to keep the vitamin D up, helps with bone mineral density and all of that. But taking oral vitamin D is absolutely appropriate all winter long. That's something I do. Vitamin C is helpful.
Right.
Staying away from sugar. The sugar we eat suppresses our immune system, sets us up.
A specific supplement that we like to use for flu prevention, it's actually been shown in a study that was done in Philadelphia, at the big medical school there. It used to be called Hahnemann. It's now renamed. It's a medical school down in Philadelphia. They did a study on something called Empower. Empower is the active hexose correlated compounds that were originating in Japan, and they actually boost immunity and help to prevent colds and flus. And then I would also suggest transfer factor. Transfer factor transfers immunity. It's a colostrum-based product that contains factors that help the white blood cells fight infection. So those are some things that can be employed. And you know, make sure you have adequate vitamin C and selenium and zinc. Those are important immune enhancers. And get adequate sleep. Get adequate rest.
People underestimate the value of sleep. When we don't get adequate sleep, it's another suppressor of the immune system. It just sets it all up.
And who gets adequate sleep these days? So, all right, so that's all the time that we have for this week's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, the Q&A. We have a couple of questions that we'll hold over till the next time. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the place to send questions, make them brief, make them of general interest. And also just here's a reminder that the products that we talk about, actually we were going to talk a little bit about D-ribose, but we didn't get a chance, did we?
No, we didn't.
Okay, we'll hold that over till next
week.
But that reminds me that, you know, if you hear about a product and you're looking for good value and good quality, drhoffman.com, the store, is a place to go. And you can get many of the products that we talk about here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. And also, you'll be subsidizing our knowledge exchange, because these podcasts are time intensive and they cost money to produce. And to some extent, your participation as a patient at the Hoffman Center or as a client of the Hoffman Center store helps to underwrite them. So barring, we're not getting any government grants, right?
No.
Why don't you see if we can get a government grant?
I'll do a grant proposal.
But Washington is shut down, so
we can't do that. Then forget it.
So we're not going to get any money. I have a tax refund coming supposedly, but but I'm sure that's not going to be in the mail for a real long time.
Oh boy, yeah.
Yeah, it's usually the other way around. Is we owe them money, but if you owe them money, you better believe they're not shut down. But my refund, that's going to be hung up in the mail. All right, so. Anyway, thanks very much for joining us. I'm
Dr.
Ronald Hoffman. Thank you, Layla. And this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.